What's it like trying to turn two former political party leaders into radio hosts? We'll find out in this edition of the weekly podcast from radiotoday.co.uk.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative radio people.
Hello, I'm Trevor Dan. Stuart Clarkson's here with the latest news. We've got David Lloyd's Radio Moments too. But first to Wogan House, home of BBC Radio 2, the UK's biggest station. There, the prestigious news and current affairs lunchtime show has been in the hands of Labour's Ed Miliband and the Tories' Ian Duncan-Smith, while Jeremy Vine has been away. I went to see producer Tim Johns, and a surprise visitor, as you'll hear, to find out about working with politicians on the other side of the mic.
Broadcast Bionics, solutions for radio, sponsors the Radio Today programme.
Tim Johns, we know you as Mr. Package. You've talked at conferences about how exciting it is to make a package. And in fact, you still do that. But you're also one of the producers of the Jeremy Vine show. And the reason I'm here is because Drew White went on Twitter and said it would be good to hear from Tim Johns what it's like working with celeb presenters. So, what's it like working with celeb presenters, Tim?
Yeah, I guess around at Radio 2 Towers, we're used to the celebrity bit. But I have to say, it was surreal is a word I used quite a bit last week to describe it. I mean, Ed Miliband, the week before he came and presented the programme, he sat in our morning meeting one morning, and I did think, well, it's like business as usual because, you know, they're all sort of big on TV, aren't they? And you get used to their voice and everything, and suddenly they're just in the same room as you and you've got your cup of tea and you're just pitching stories as normal, and then suddenly Ed Miliband chips in with something. It's surreal. So that's the first thing. Secondly, I suppose once you get on the day, especially with a fairly high-pressure, busy daily show, you sort of get on with things as normal and occasionally blink and kick yourself and go, hang on, this is not normal at all. So in some senses, it was fairly normal. And because you're all working together, and especially for Ed Miliband and Ian Duncan-Smith, they're stepping into a completely alien world. So very suddenly, well, instantly, you're on the same level. So they become human immediately. And, you know, there's no time for too many formalities. You're straight in there with Ed, do this, and he's asking you, well, what about this? And they're leaning on you and trusting you very quickly, and you have some respect for them and the positions they have. So very quickly, it almost becomes quite a normal situation in the most abnormal of circumstances.
I sort of imagined that you would have sat the presenters at a round table and you would have had somebody else, possibly you, sitting in the Jeremy Vine seat. But the photographs have got Ian and Ed actually sitting in the driving seat. Is that how it's worked?
Yeah, they were cueing the music, talking up to the vocals, smashing in the jingles. That's not quite the case. The Radio 2 studios are set up, so you can basically operate the whole thing from the production booth or from the main desk. So they can sit in the presenter's chair and actually not touch a single button.
But that means, I guess, they can see the screens with the messages.
Yes, we're very old-fashioned, just to break another illusion. We do it all by paper.
So no.
All they can see is what track is coming next and the red light, which means they're live to the nation. But beyond that, there's one button they use, which is the talk back, to talk to Phil, the editor, primarily, and say, what's happening next?
So what help did you have to give both of them about the music, you know, pronouncing Duran Duran or whoever it was going to be? That must have been an accident waiting to happen.
Like many successful large radio programmes, a lot of radio rules we sort of break. And because our focus is always on news and current affairs, we sort of have the mantra that whatever happens with the music happens. We don't have the time to coach these people into being top presenters. So they can either introduce the music or it sounds terrible. There's no point wasting time faffing around going, no, say Duran Duran like this. So long as they knew what the music was, what happened, happened. And it wasn't always smooth, but that was part of the charm. I think Ed got one of the songs. He said, here's what a Queen, and it came out with ABBA, or the other way around. And Ian had the same thing yesterday. So we're not too fussy. And actually, we said to them, look, if you're making mistakes like time or you say this guest is here and they're not there, and it doesn't matter on the scale of things. What matters is energy and pace and engagement and talking to listeners and being impartial as you can. And the meaty content and what we're actually talking about is overwhelmingly what matters on this occasion.
Well, you mentioned impartiality. That must be one of the difficult things, or is it?
It was a risk. The whole thing for us, as much as anyone else, was a risk. We didn't do loads of dry runs. We didn't, you know, it was like, well, let's book them, hope they're good. They've never done it before, and see what happens. And, you know, it's good to take risks. And impartiality was one of them. I mean, our thinking is, although it may be hard for lots of people to believe, you do not ever get to lead a political party unless you're a clever person. No matter what your political leanings and what you think of them, they are clever people. And, you know, if you're aware of the arguments one side, well, you're probably best placed to know the arguments of your opponent. We told them from the outset, you're going to have to do this. And they both said, yeah, I get that. And actually, an interview last week Ed did with Chukwuma Munna about Brexit, he played devil's advocate brilliantly. And today, actually, Ian Duncan-Smith with his colleague Owen Paterson. Again, he absolutely laid out the arguments, the opposing arguments. And on that front, touch wood, because we're not through the week yet, it actually really hasn't been a problem.
You know, I'm so interested you should say this, because I think we're going through a phase where people listening to the radio and watching the television are prizing authenticity more than they like just the touting of the party line, the old, you know, strong and stable coalition of chaos, the repetition of the message. I think it's been interesting that both Ed and even more so IDS, who you think of as being very partisan, when faced with, well, you can't do that, just adapt very nicely to being, you know, impartial and playing it straight.
They all have different sides to them. And Ed Miliband, and he won't mind me saying this because his week was a roaring success, but when he's reading the script into the piece, because we script the intro to make sure, you know, we're legally accurate and watertight, etc. And then the interview that follows is much more, they're much more free to roam where they like. And he won't mind me saying that the intro was the clunky bit. And then when his personality was allowed the freedom to roam where it pleased, when he was shearing dogs or singing death metal, you know, he's shone through and people suddenly write in to us and they say, never been a fan of his politics, didn't like him, but I have to say, I'm really getting to know this guy and like this guy. And I can't help but wonder that it's that scripted bit that is, that's the side of him we saw when he was party leader and, you know, maybe why he never quite made it to number 10. Perhaps, I don't want to be unkind to him, but it's the space and the time to finally dig down and get some personality that makes it.
Do we learn something about radio from what it's like putting somebody like that in a position like that, where they have to talk to the public? It's not about just following the party line. And they do find some inner resources that enable them to do that. Does it show us something about what actually makes a great radio presenter?
Yes, I suppose it's funny for us how the success of last week was much more about personality and production. And by that I mean Ed, when he came out of his shell, was a great listen because he's funny and everything else. And production in terms of, I think, I would like to think that the topics we chose to talk about and the focus and some of the fun we had.
Well, this may be where you came in. Was it your idea to do toilets?
My colleague Pete, another producer, pitched toilets. My editor, Phil, had to say to Ed, no, there's a lot going on today, but this is one of the things we're going to do.
That's a pitching meeting I think we'd all have enjoyed attending.
I'll say no more. I'll say no more.
There is your editor. Hello, your editor.
Hello.
Come in, come in. We're on the radio today. Podcast.
Fantastic.
And I'm interviewing...
How exciting to see
you. No, sit down. I was just interviewing Tim about...
He's far more important than I am.
Well, that's not what he says.
And more talented. Far more talented. He's the most talented producer I've ever worked with.
Is that true?
Absolutely.
Because why?
I tell everybody every day, yeah. He really is. I mean, his ability, you've heard some of his packages, haven't you? I mean,
he is Mr. Package.
His ability to do packages is extraordinary. He's also his political work, his ability to do a political story is excellent as well. And that's not easy. And also, he's just an all-round, very quietly gets on with it. dead good bloke.
Let's let him just stew in the corner. No, you got Phil, just while you're here, because I was going to ask him this, but I'll ask you first as you're here. You're the editor of the Jeremy Vine Show, so you must come up against the whole business of how rigorous is your journalism and all those kind of real big BBC issues about the black and the white, the binary use of interviewing techniques and all that kind of stuff. It's interesting, isn't it, having two former party leaders on and watching them just relax? And does it make you wish that more politicians went for that kind of relaxed, authentic approach and less for the just the party line by rote?
If you're asking about how easy is it for them to be impartial, which I thought you were getting to, I think it's fairly easy. I mean, that's the kind of easy bit. The only person who had... I mean, I go right back to when we had Neil Kinnock and Charles Kennedy do the show, and we also had Geoffrey Archer in. He's the only person I've ever worked with. He's a lovely man, actually. I'm surprised by how nice he was on a sort of individual basis, but he didn't get impartiality. He didn't get he couldn't even play devil's advocate. He literally had to say, they have asked me to ask this question because I'm being told I'm being rather biased here. So he's the only person that, people, I've lost count of the number of people who said to me, Ian Duncan Smith, he never, on Brexit, he's fought for Brexit for the last 50 years. The idea that he will be impartial on Brexit, he was, because he got it. He's not stupid. We bring him in as a BBC journalist and he plays the role of a BBC journalist.
Now, when you came in, Tim was explaining about the pitching of the idea to do toilets with Ed Miliband. So what was the...
Are we going to be honest here?
Yeah. Well, I said you had to say that's what we're doing on a busy day and I went no further, so up to
that's
you.
What we're doing on a busy day. Ed didn't want to do it. Is that what we're getting at? Ed looked at me. I mean, I think they come in because they say they listen to the show. They don't really listen. I mean, they get in the car driving to constituencies. They might catch the odd thing. They think we just do politics. I mean, we do politics, but we do a whole load of other rubbish as well often. And we had a big political... So I can't remember what we did on that Tuesday. We certainly led on politics. What else did we do?
We did something like Brexit in Grenfell Tower. We had two proper...
There was enough serious stuff. He wanted to do a post-mortem about the election, why the middle class voted Labour, or something about mainstream media, nobody pays attention anymore. He couldn't understand why the whole show wasn't going to be on politics. And I got a very good pitch on from one of the producers on this story about water-wise. I think it's how inefficient modern lavatories are, which for us is kind of bread and butter. Brilliant. I mean, this combines the seriousness of wasting water with a great opportunity to get the listeners into... And how simple... The medium is just so... Sometimes beautifully simple, isn't it? You just ask the listeners to go into their loos with their mobile phones and get them to flush their toilets. Even I was astonished at the amount of attention it got. When I finished the meeting and said, we're going to do toilets, Ed looked at me and said, what? Couldn't understand why we were going to do toilets. And... wasn't particularly happy, but I must say, I mean, he was very gracious about it afterwards. He realised that it kind of put him on the map, that item.
It's Ed Miliband sitting in for Jeremy Vine. Now, I'm also delighted to say that Mathilde Sazio from Brixton in South London has got in touch with us. I believe she actually has an old Victorian toilet. Mathilde, is that right?
Yes, well, we have two. We have an outdoor flusher and an indoor, so yeah.
Do you use the outdoor? In the warm weather,
really.
maybe
not really.
Right, and tell us, how have you come to have this old-fashioned Thunderbox toilet?
Well, it's my parents. It's my parents' house, so they live in a Victorian house, and so it's got all the original period features.
Right, and I think you're going to do a flush for us. We're going to compare it to the British Toilet Association modern flush and see if we can tell the difference.
Well, modern loos lack the drama of what you're about to hear, so are you ready? Here we go.
Go on. You can't argue with that, can you?
Who can tell me about how Ed ended up interviewing his brother David?
Well, I can. I mean, when he did The Trail with Ken Bruce, Ken said that was an easy booking. nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, it's no secret. The relationship between the two brothers is still not what it was. It's still kind of a little bit fraught. They get on okay now, but they're not as they were beforehand, before Ed applied for the job as Labour leader and got it, when David thought it was his. So we were keen to do it, not just because it would be amazing to get Ed Miliband interviewing David Miliband, but it was actually an idea from, I think it originally came from Justine, Ed's wife, because we were talking about maybe it'd be interesting for Ed to interview David on the programme. And Justine said, have you seen the TED talk that David did? So I watched it that evening and I thought it was pretty sensational. It was an amazing TED talk. And I said to Ed, let's get him in on that. Let's see if he will, because obviously he's not going to come on and play the media game and brothers reconciliation. And so it's very much editorially led, leading on the story that we thought was quite serious, because, you know, we've done all the stuff about what are all the, we done, we mentioned toilets, we've done
Death metal.
We've done
shaving dogs.
You've done how to cool down by putting cold flannels on you with Jeremy Corbyn's brother and Thomas Schaffernacker and everybody else. So we've done a good mix of serious and silly. And we thought this was a... And we already knew we were going to finish that day with Is Your Long-Haired Dog Suffering in the Heat? And recreating a doggy poodle parlour, or what was it?
Yeah, a dog grooming parlour.
Dog grooming parlour in the studio. So we had the silliness to go out with, so we thought this was quite a serious subject, and we can put David Miliband as well. Brilliant. And he agreed to do it.
Hi, Dave. Are you on the line?
Yes.
Thanks
yes,
so much.
I am.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah.
So, look, we'll talk a bit about our family's story later, but you travel to refugee camps all over the world. And sometimes if you tell one person's story, it reveals a bigger picture. Can you tell us the story of somebody you've met in your job at the International Rescue Committee?
Yes, I mean, the best thing is to start last week, because this time last week I was in Uganda. It's a country that's received nearly 1 million refugees over the last 11 months. And I met Anna. She is a woman who stood up in a community meeting in this clearing in Kampala, the capital of Uganda, and she explained how she'd watched, and she literally said this, she'd watched her siblings being sliced up in front of her very eyes.
Now, look, we've had a comment in from Graham in Worcester. He says this, and I just want to put this to you and then get your reaction. We're a small country. We cannot keep taking people in. Our infrastructure can't support it. Furthermore, most of the problems in this country come from immigrants refusing to accept our way of life. That's an undeniable fact. If we don't stand up now and defend our country from immigrants and refugees, we'll end up countryless.
Well, I would say to Graham two things. First of all, the whole history of Britain, not just for the last 20 years, but for hundreds of years, is from people coming to the country and making a contribution. We should demand that they integrate. It's right that they learn English. It's imperative that they get to work and make a contribution to the society. But our history in Britain is of people contributing and helping make Britain the great country it is and can be.
Phil, I'm going to let you go because this is the Tim Johns show,
exactly.
Really.
Yes,
it was very nice to see you, though. Take care. Well, that was Phil Jones, your boss, who obviously thinks a lot of you. I think there's a pay rise, just around the corner.
You're joking. This is the BBC.
Now, look, I was going to ask you while I was here, though, because I'm interested in the whole business of being a young assistant producer in a place like this. You're working as a team, and in a lot of commercial radio stations, they don't really do teams anymore, do they? There's a producer, there's one person. Now, I wonder if you could talk about that and how that sort of works from the perspective of somebody like yourself who's, you know, on the way up in the business.
It's amazing when people come and maybe sit in and watch the show go out, depending on where they come from. If they've come from, you know, a commercial radio show that you described, they're like, oh, you got loads of people. They come from the Today programme, Radio 4, they're like, there's no one here. There's a good handful of producers. We, as the Jeremy Vine show, we're not separate to Radio 2 in the slightest, but we're obviously doing a news and current affairs programme, so I can only really talk about our day in, day out is intensely that handful who work on that programme, and being part of that team is invaluable, and the show would not sound anything like it did, I don't think, without that. So I've always worked in as part of a team. I was in BBC Local Radio before that, and I got started in student radio, and I love a good team. I don't think you have to be part of a team to get on. You know, if you're working on your own or freelancing or whatever, you get to know people in your own ways. But
I think what you have got, though, is the freedom to be a studio producer and a package maker and a journalist. And sometimes people think those are three different things, but you can do all of them.
People always say to me, as they probably say to anyone working in radio, oh, what's next for you? And the honest truth is, right now, if we've got the same sort of funding and structure, and I'm working with a presenter I get on with and a team who I love, and I've got a great boss like Phil, I'm going to stay put for a while, because you're right that I count myself lucky in that it's what I want to do. I want to make packages, but I want to produce and I want to work in news on a big programme. I consider myself lucky that I've got all that here, and people might think, oh, you might want to work on the tape programme, or okay, but you're a much smaller cog in a bigger wheel, and you are almost always either producing or you're just a dedicated reporter. This is like a fun little local radio show on a rather bigger level.
Tim Johns, thank you.
Thank you.
And before we leave the Jeremy Vine Show, I can't resist playing you this from Radio 4's Dead Ringers.
Eddie, what in the name of sweet baby Cambrose are you doing?
Oh, hello, Jeremy.
You're sinking my ship, Ed. This is the Jeremy Vine Show. People want their ear holes filled with a sexy slice of excitement and a big dollop of dry cured enthusiasm. Now, intro the next track.
It's Walking on Sunshine.
No. Do it like this, Ed. Coming up, we have Walking on Sunshine by Katrina Underwood. Now, you try.
This is Walking on Sunshine.
Okay.
Which, at the current rate of global warming, is only too likely.
No!
Sorry.
Listen to me. Let me do it. Before the news, we have the B-52s with Love Shack. Great track from 1990. Absolute classic.
Great track. Although, in my belief, no one this day and age should be forced to live in a shack. We need to address the housing crisis.
No! Ed, I'm going to tell you a secret. The trick to being multi-award-winning broadcaster, Jeremy Vine, is simply getting really excited at the end of every single sentence until you feel like your head might explode! And then you go very, very quiet. Try it yourself.
Okay.
Go on.
Here's Simple Minds. And don't you forget about me!
Oh, that's so good, Ed. You're going to be fantastic.
You see, I'm more than just an internet meme.
So thanks again to Phil Jones and Tim Johns at Radio 2. In a minute, David Lloyd's Radio Moments for this week. But first, the latest news with Stuart Clarkson.
Thank you, Trevor, and welcome back. This week, BBC Radio cricket commentator Henry Blofeld has announced he's retiring after 45 years on Test Match Special. He'll step down after the England-West Indies Test Match in early September. Blowers joined TMS in 1972. BBC Cymru has a new head of news. Garmon Rees will oversee news and current affairs in Welsh for radio, online, TV and mobile platforms. Meanwhile, BBC Radio Cymru 2 is to launch on DAB in Wales. It follows a trial last year with an extra digital service. The English language station BBC Radio Wales is getting more FM transmitters, meanwhile, to increase its coverage of the country from 79% to 91%. Some Radio 3 frequencies are being swapped over to Radio Wales to make it happen. If you're one of those people who flicks onto 252 longwave every now and then just to check the transmitter's still pumping something out, then don't be alarmed if you don't hear anything. The old Atlantic frequency is now being used by RTE Radio 1, of course, from Ireland. It's off air for engineering work till the 7th of July. RTE had previously said they were going to shut down the longwave service, but a campaign from Irish communities here in the UK means it's staying until at least 2019. The broadcaster's hoping legislation will change, which would allow it to go on DAB here in the UK. Another producer's making the move from Leicester Square to One Golden Square. Dan Pryor is the latest to quit Global for Bauer. The Classic FM and Smooth and Gold imaging producer is off to Absolute as station imaging producer. BBC Essex has a new podcast series out called Brexit Britain. The station says it won't feature politicians or experts, just real people, in their own words, recorded on location in their everyday lives. And congratulations to the new fellows of the Radio Academy who were honoured at the Radio Festival last week. Fellowships were presented to radio players Michael Hill, Radio 2 2's network editor Helen Thomas, Absolute Radio's Paul Sylvester and Nikki Nest from BFBS, as well as the festival organisers John Tiarent and Nikki Holiday. Well done to all of those guys. And that's it from me this week. There's more news daily, of course, at radiotoday.co.uk.
Your best content, shareable and discoverable on any platform. Oasis from Broadcast Bionics helps you build a closer relationship with your listeners. Welcome to the social studio at bionics.co.uk. Radio
Moments. This year sees the 50th anniversary of BBC Local Radio. And it was this week in 1968 that BBC Leeds opened. Let's tune in to an early show, shall we?
You're listening to the sound of your own local station, BBC Radio Leeds, broadcasting on 271 metres medium wave, 92.4 VHF. It's exactly 3:15 in time for tea break.
How great is that? Back in the days when programmes started at very old times, they all had titles and very jolly theme tunes. I could listen to this all day. Goodness, in its early days, BBC Radio Leeds chose to mix its local and national stories in its own bulletins, which wasn't the official BBC local radio approach back then. Oh, no.
Leeds and the World at One. This is Alan Shaw reporting. When we set up our own news service, it was an interesting experiment. We were the only station to collect our own news. Other stations relied solely on outside freelanced news agencies. We also did our own national and international news, and I remember we were the first outpost of the BBC to mention that war had actually broken out in Czechoslovakia.
There was a terrible rumpus about doing that, and indeed the BBC, I think it's an open secret, were not at all pleased at the idea of our endeavouring to cover the world as well as Leeds.
Happy 49th birthday, BBC Radio Leeds. Now, this is all too common, isn't it? Just getting the names of your own contributors mixed up. Here's John Humphreys.
And a bioethicist has called for the NHS to offer to freeze the sperm of all 18-year-olds. Today's newsreader is Diana Spencer. It's Diana's speed. Forgive me.
No, not at all. David Cameron will formally present his proposals for European Union reform at a summit in Brussels.
John Humphreys with his regal newsreader this week 2 years ago. And more importantly, whatever happened to that European Union reform? Now, staying on the theme of John's news item, 2 years ago this week, Sandy Toksvig hosted her final edition of The News Quiz.
Before we leave you, here is a cutting from a Times article about Danish sperm donors.
Jesper, a student, has been donating 2 or 3 times a week for a year at the Nordic Cryobank. I'm only 22, he said, so I plan to carry on donating as long as I can. There's no point pulling out now.
And with that, for the very last time, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Francis Green, Andy Hamilton, Jeremy Hardy and Phil Jupitus. In the chair was Sandy Toksvig.
Farewell, Sandy Toksvig from Radio 4's The News Quiz this week in 2015. The programme itself is 40 years old this year, originally hosted by Barry Norman. This week in 1968, Huey Green wrote to The Times disputing the government's claim that only 10 AM stations could be on air in the UK without interference. His studies suggested 80. Huey was a leading light in the campaign for commercial radio, although he was to be disappointed in his efforts to play a part once it arrived. And maybe that was why he was a little disgruntled when grabbed by Radio Trent newsman John Darby about the end of his TV show Opportunity Knocks.
All right. Huey, do you think there's any danger that now that the show is over, you may be forgotten?
I couldn't care less whether I'm forgotten or not. I mean, that doesn't matter. I mean, you know, you can see all the people. Have you forgotten me?
No.
Have you forgotten me? I mean, that's a kind of a snide remark you would get from somebody from Toronto. That's why people in Montreal hate Torontonians. They always say, oh, you know, so-and-so, you're so-and-so. And we've got a much nicer city in Montreal than you have in Toronto. Now go and ask something else nasty.
Well, what are you going to be doing now?
That's none of your business. Now ask another smart question.
You must have some future.
Never mind. Now, may I ask you a question?
You certainly may.
Why don't you shave? Ladies and gentlemen, we have just been talking to the four-eyed interviewer from Radio Trent. And it has been a delight. We're all enjoying ourselves. Now, why don't you go back to your morgue and bury yourself? Thank you very much indeed. Come over here and we'll do some more signing, ladies and gentlemen.
I think even the punters were a bit embarrassed by that. Huey Green talking to Radio Trent journalist John Darby. Huey's commercial radio dream did come to pass, although it was not always plain sailing, not least when you lose your licence.
Dear Radio Victory, I am very, very sorry you are closing down so soon. It is a shame. The IBA are horrible. I always tune into Radio Victory in the mornings and evenings. Love from Sean Thomas.
I heard the news from the authority of our not getting the second franchise. I had to break it, the news, to the staff the following morning, and I did dread that moment, but I needn't have done. The staff were more than magnificent, the way they received the news, and I did say at that time that we must now go on with dignity. Let us leave memories of dignity, of Radio Victory in real style. And I can say I'm absolutely overwhelmed the way that all the staff, and I'm sitting amongst them now, and I really mean this, they've been tremendous.
The end of Radio Victory in Portsmouth this week in 1986. It was replaced by Ocean and Power, now Heart and Capital. Heart and Capital are now owned by Global Radio, of course, and it was this week, 10 years ago, that Global was born, with the announcement that Heart, together with LBC and Galaxy, were to be sold to the new operator by the Chrysalis Group. 35 years ago this week, Ray Moore permanently took over the early show on Radio 2, the programme which was to define him.
It's the 31st of August today, so some people, hopefully, he says, might be thinking about renewing their radio and television licences. On a value-for-money note, are you one of those people who think that the £6 a bit steep to pay for the combined radio and television licence? Well then, just let me quote you this. From the BBC Handbook of 1970 shows that ours is in fact the second cheapest licence fee in Europe. The lowest fee, in fact, is that of Ireland, who pay £5 a year. Dearest listening and viewing is in Norway. The licence works out at slightly over £1 a month if you're living in Norway. A few more examples. The Netherlands, £6.04 a year. France, £7.10. Belgium and Italy, £8. Sweden, £10.17. And Switzerland, £11.18. It's not such bad value for money after all, is it?
That was a hell of a talk-up, wasn't it? The great Ray Moore from earlier in his Radio 2 career. He began on Early's Proper this week in 1982. Much missed as well. So, with the end of Capital Disney 10 years ago...
Just as you're growing up and making new friends, you're also trying out new things, making new friends and saying goodbye to old... So are we.
The start of Super Gold 27 years ago.
This is Chilton Radio Super Gold.
And Apple launching Beats One 2 years ago.
My name is Ebro. This is Beats One, broadcasting now on Apple Music. And let's not forget tomorrow, Eminem and Zane Lowe.
Those are this week's Radio Moments.
Marconi made it, and we love it. Radio Moments.
Thank you, David. Next week, I'll be talking to the producer of, in my opinion, one of the best programmes and podcasts of 2017 so far, the wonderful Our Man in the Middle East by Jeremy Bowen. Join me for that if you can. This has been a TDC production. Cheers.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creating and distributing clever software for radio.